Eventually, they grew chilled, even through their insulation suits. So he and Danny rose to the surface, and Danny triggered the transponder that would bring her hovercraft flying toward them. They took off their dive suits and let the sun warm them as they ate their lunch. And then, while digesting, they simply relaxed, stretched out side by side on the foredeck.
"You said you weren't working?" Jason asked.
"No.
I was working for the Jedi until my unit began to achieve results. And then we were co-opted by the government."
Jason rolled on his side to look at her.
"But you've done such crucial work. You discovered how to jam the Yamisk signal. That's the single critical discovery that's enabled our ships to survive battle with the Yuuzhan Vong. Why would they disband your group now?"
She turned her green eyes to his. "Astrophysicists aren't important for war work." A strange look came into her face, and she sat up, crossing her legs and leaning toward Jason. "Not all the theoretical work has been pushed aside. There's some still going on, and it's kind of strange."
"Tell me."
"We had some people in our group who were working the details of Yuuzhan Vong bioscience. They made a discovery, and right away were pulled away into a new unit in the intelligence division. They're working directly under a group of Chiss, who report directly to Diff Scour."
Jason looked at her. "Do you know the nature of the discovery the bioscientists made?"
She nodded. "It had to do with Yuuzhan Vong genetics, which are generally like ours, by the way."
Jason blinked. "That's pretty odd, considering they're from another galaxy."
"There's one bit of their genetics that isn't like us," Danny said. "There's a sequence that seems completely unique, and it's common to all Yuuzhan Vong life. Yorick coral, Yamisks, plant life, the Yuuzhan Vong themselves, all of it."
The next day, Jason went to the reef again with Danny, this time with her friend Thesper Trode, a female Ishi Tib, whose dive gear had been adapted to her giant head and eyes that thrust out on stalks. After the dive, he invited Thesper and Danny to the suite for snacks, but when he opened the door, he saw Jaina standing in the front room, still in her pilot's coveralls, her military duffel partly open on the floor. He and Jaina stared at each other for a long moment of exquisitely painful joy. And then their twin bond flared with 1,000 shared emotions and memories, the rich harvest of lives shared since their first day in their mother's womb, and they rushed into an embrace. They pounded each other on the back and laughed until the tears came. Family was another thing that Jason had surrendered to the Yuuzhan Vong. The sensation of finding his twin again took his breath away. When he found it again, he looked at the insignia on Jaina's coveralls.
"You're a major now?"
"I'm better than that. I'm a Holovid star, not to mention a goddess."
Her eyes shifted to the two visitors standing near the door. She knew Danny Kui, of course, but had to be introduced to Danny's friend Thesper.
"I have to change now and run," Jaina said. "I've got dispatches to deliver to headquarters. And I've got a personal message from Admiral Creefy to Uncle Luke. He wants Jedi."
Jason was pleasantly surprised.
"At least someone wants us."
She took a more formal uniform out of her duffel, disappeared into a bedroom to change, and then returned only to head for the door.
"We'll talk later, right?" she said as she paused on the threshold. "I want to hear everything."
And then she was gone. Jason gazed at the closing door in surprise, as his mind tingled with the sensation of the fading twin bond. Luke and Mara returned before Jaina did. When Jaina finally arrived, she was taut and high-strung, her neck and shoulder muscles rigid with tension. First, she delivered Creefy's request for more Jedi pilots to Luke, who was pleased to hear that someone in the military was willing to take Jedi. Jaina and her duffel moved in to share Jason's room. He wanted to talk to her before sleep, but she said she was exhausted from her long journey from Kashyyyk. She'd talk to him in the morning. Jason fell asleep at once and dreamed of the coral reef. He was awakened 2 hours before dawn with the arrival of his parents. Half awake,
He stood in the door while his father howled his happiness like a Wookiee, picked Jason off the floor, and whirled him around as if he were a 2-year-old. Leia's emotion was less demonstrative, but no less powerful, and Jason felt it through the Force, even as his father twirled him through the air. When Jason found his feet again, he embraced his mother, and he sensed the Force of Leia's profound thankfulness. The hours that followed were exuberant and very emotional. Han was almost bouncing off the walls in his joy, at least when he wasn't trying to conceal a tear in his eye. The Solo family, with C-3PO, moved to another apartment along with Leia's Nogri bodyguards. Jason hoped Vergère might come along, but Luke rather firmly stated that she would remain as his guest. It was probably a good idea, Jason reflected later. When his parents found out what Vergère had actually done to him when he was a prisoner, they wouldn't have looked at the little alien kindly. Jason would hate to have to get between Vergère and Han's blaster. Four days into his term of office, Cal Omis summoned Admiral Akbar and Winter to the former resort hotel that now housed the executive branch of government. The meeting was small. The only other guests were Luke, Idar Nilai Kirka of Fleet Intelligence, New Republic Intelligence Chief Diff Scour, and Supreme Commander Cien Sov. YVH droids patrolled the corridor outside. Scour's people had thoroughly swept the room for listening devices, and so had Nilai Kirka's, who sneaked in later without Scour's knowledge. On one wall, a little fountain tinkled and chimed, emitting a mild scent of brine.
"I would like to thank you all for agreeing to meet with me," Akbar said.
"We're never too busy to meet with one of the greatest heroes of the rebellion," Cal Omis said.
"That's very kind," Akbar said.
His trembling hands keyed a data pad on the table before him.
"I have been thinking a great deal about the Yuuzhan Vong, the greatest menace to the security of the galaxy since Palpatine. Let's open the survey with our military. We are growing stronger. When the war started, contracts were awarded in order to increase our force strength. More capital ships, more fighters, more transports, larger ground forces. The shipyards at Kuat, Talan, Corellia, and here on Mon Calamari have been disrupted by the war, but not fatally injured. And now they are delivering new capital ships, while many contractors dispersed throughout friendly space are delivering large numbers of smaller craft. We also have many new recruits," Akbar went on. "Despite the efforts of the Peace Brigade and others favoring surrender to the Yuuzhan Vong, many idealistic citizens have volunteered for the military. The drawback to so many new ships and personnel is that they are untried. Successful actions against the Yuuzhan Vong have been few, so there is no standard fleet doctrine based on consistent success in battle. Our problems have been compounded by failures in intelligence. We were invaded by an unknown enemy of unknown force, of a species unknown to us, and impelled by unknown motives. Small wonder that we could not predict their actions. That lack has, to a degree, been remedied with better knowledge of the enemy and with agents now in place on enemy worlds. So much for our capabilities." Akbar paused, and one large hand loosened his collar. "I should like to continue with an analysis of the enemy. The Yuuzhan Vong invasion of our galaxy has a religious justification. Perhaps the leadership cynically uses religion to camouflage other less noble reasons for the assault, but there is no doubt that most Yuuzhan Vong sincerely believe that their gods have given our worlds to them. Because they have no doubts on this score, they form a highly motivated, dedicated, tenacious, and ideologically unified core of invaders. Our attempts to divide or corrupt them have been fruitless. The enemy's greatest successes have been in the realm of intelligence. The galaxy was thoroughly scouted before the first attack. Spies and informers were placed or recruited throughout all target areas. Our government was penetrated at its highest levels. Agents such as Nomanor had stirred civil conflict that distracted us from the real threat of invasion. Material losses are irrelevant to the Yuuzhan Vong. Apparently their ships are grown and harvested like interstellar fruit. They can have as many warships as they can find Vong and Vong collaborators to crew them. And as for crews, I have on my data pad some estimates of initial Yuuzhan Vong's strength and their casualties thus far in the war. You may view these figures, if you like, on your own data pads. I am prepared to send them to you. Luke took out his data pad and set it to receive. Figures shimmered across its screens. Luke looked at Akbar in astonishment. We've killed almost a third of their warriors?
So these figures imply. They're very approximate, Cal Omas pointed out.
They're the best we have, Akbar said. I don't think they're far wrong.
If these figures are correct, Cal said, I don't want to throw our fleets at the enemy on the basis of guesswork.
There are ways of testing whether the figures are correct, Akbar said. If the Yuuzhan Vong stage another large offensive against a major target in the next 2 months, we'll know that they have warriors to spare. If instead they consolidate their gains, we'll know that their losses have taught them caution. The Yuuzhan Vong warriors are brave. They are aggressive. They obey orders without hesitation, fight to the death, retreat reluctantly or never, and never surrender. Considering their other advantages, it is lucky for us that they possess these weaknesses.
Luke stared at Akbar. Of course. Why hadn't he realized this before?
Weaknesses.
Scour's astonished cry filled the air.
You call these weaknesses?
Of course, Akbar said simply.
We can count on the enemy to have these traits.
That means they are predictable. And while each of these traits may be admirable in itself, together they add up to massive and systematic weaknesses.
He held up one giant hand.
Consider. Bravery and aggression result in foolhardy courage, and in any case are useful only with adequate direction. Unthinking obedience means a lack of flexibility. To fight to the death and never to surrender is to deny oneself useful alternatives. Together, we can use these Yuuzhan Vong traits to draw the enemy into a trap from which he will never escape.
A trap, Luke said, implies bait. And the bait must be real, Akbar said. It must be something for which the Yuuzhan Vong will commit all their available strength.
And what is that? Cal asked.
Us, I suppose,
Diff Scour said, looking about the table.
The government. What sort of timing are you considering? When should this trap be set?
At the moment we have a great advantage, Akbar said. We can defeat their Yamasks. We can confuse their communications and cause them to fire at one another. We don't know if these advantages will last for long, so we should seek a decisive battle very soon.
But most of our forces are inexperienced,
Sian Sov said quickly.
You have said this yourself. Dare we fight a decisive battle with so many raw troops?
No, Akbar said. We daren't. Our forces must be seasoned in battle before we attempt a major engagement.
How do we season them without a major engagement?
Difskar asked.
Through many small engagements, Akbar said. The Yuuzhan Vong now have the same disadvantage that we had at the beginning. They have too many worlds to defend. We should let the fleet loose on these targets, on all of them.
He held up a hand.
But we should never attack where we know the Yuuzhan Vong to be strong. Never engage where we do not possess an advantage. Our military must be seasoned, but seasoned only in victory.
His huge Popeyes turned toward Admiral Sov.
You must give your commanders a great deal of initiative in choosing their targets. But you must never engage the enemy where he is strong, only where he is weak.
The rebellion all over again,
Cal Omas said.
But when we fought the Empire, we didn't have so many places to defend. Our government was small and able to move to places like Yavin or Hoth.
We must defend only those places that are vital to the war,
Akbar said.
They must be defended, as we defended Coruscant and Borlaeus, to the point where even a victory would cost the enemy too much.
And what places are those? Cal asked.
Places where the new fleet elements are coming into being. Mon Calamari, Quat, Corellia.
Akbar sighed again.
That's all.
That's all?
Cal said.
Anything else?
Akbar waved a hand.
Give away when the enemy attacks.
I ask again for your timetable,
Difskaur said.
How long before you think the fleet will be ready for a major action, or for this decisive battle your plan calls for?
Akbar's response was swift.
3 months.
3 months.
A cold smile played about Scour's cadaverous face.
The timing is expedient.
The timing for what? Luke wondered. There was something highly significant about that 3 months. But Luke and Akbar were two, at least, who weren't meant to know what it was. I would like to welcome everyone, Luke said. To this first meeting of the... He hesitated, then looked to Cal Omas. What is it anyway? We're not the Jedi Council, with half of us not being Jedi. Cal hesitated too.
Let's just call it the High Council for now, he said.
It wasn't the most auspicious of beginnings. The hotel room that had been given to the Council was oddly shaped, and like many of the rooms requisitioned by the hastily formed government, smelled of fresh paint. To Luke's right was the Wookiee Senator Trebek, large and hairy and snarling with vigor. To the right of Trebek sat the Jedi healer Silgal, her protuberant Mon Calamari eyes able to scan the entire room. At the end of the table was Intelligence Director Difskaur, whose thin human frame withstood the crowding at the table better than most. To Scour's right sat Kenth Hamner, a human Jedi retired from the military, who sat rigidly upright and wore his well-tailored civilian suit as if it were a uniform. To Hamner's right was the soft-spoken Talaam Ranth, the Gotal senator, whose support had given Cal his majority in the Senate, and who had demanded a seat in the council as a reward for his loyalty. To Talaam's right was Cal, and to Cal's right was Kip Durin. To Kip's right was the golden-furred Minister of State, Relikli Aukla, daughter of the late Elagos Aukla, the Kalmasi senator, who had been ritually sacrificed by the Yuuzhan Vong under Brilliant. To Relikli's right, at the cramped far end of the table, sat the erect figure of Saba Sebatine, who regarded the others with bright, intent, reptilian eyes. To Saba's right was Sian Sov, the supreme commander, and between Sov and Luke bulked the wrinkled gray frame of the Chev Jedi Knight, Trasina Lobi, whose long snout was partly unrolled on the surface of the table. Luke looked at the datapad and the notes he'd made to himself about the meeting.
Does anyone wish to offer a report?
Master Skywalker.
Kip raised a hand.
Master Durin?
Kip's discomfort showed plainly on his face.
Can you explain to me why I'm here? I've been a lot of trouble to you, and I hardly think I've earned a place here.
While that may be true, Luke said, that doesn't mean you haven't earned a seat. You're one of our most experienced Jedi, particularly in fighting the Yuuzhan Vong. I think your voice on the Council is necessary and welcome, though I won't keep you here if you insist on resigning.
Kip was exasperated.
I don't want to go against your wishes yet again, Master Skywalker.
In that case, stay.
Since you asked for news, Kip said, I have information from Kashyyyk, from Lobaka and the team of Wookiees who are investigating Yuuzhan Vong biotechnology.
Go ahead, Luke said.
They've been working with the Dovin Basals from the captured frigate Trickster, Kip said. They're now able to use our own interdiction technology to duplicate the effects of Dovin Basal space mines. Since the war began, the Vong have used their mines to yank our ships out of hyperspace and ambush them with fighter craft. And now it looks as if we'll be able to do the same to them.
Sian Sov was pleased.
Splendid. That will fit in well with Admiral Akbar's plan.
Perhaps Admiral Sov should explain Akbar's plan for those of us who haven't heard it,
Cal said.
Perhaps only the first part,
Diff Scour cautioned.
The plan's ultimate objective is perhaps beyond the scope of this meeting.
Sov obliged Scour by explaining Akbar's plan to season the Republic's raw recruits through a series of skirmishes and small engagements, rather than risking a large battle.
Admiral Creefy, he finished, has requested as many Jedi pilots as possible. He hopes to merge many elements of this fleet into what he calls the Jedi Meld, so that all may maneuver together as one. He reports he's had limited success with this tactic at Obroa Sky, but needs more Jedi to make it more effective.
I've also received a message from Creefy requesting Jedi, Luke said. I have no objection to sending any who wish to go.
I hope the Council can see its way to helping Creefy, Cal said.
Kip cleared his throat and half-heartedly raised a hand.
Yes, Luke said.
I'm sorry to have to say this, but we may have a potential problem with Admiral Creefy. He's a good commander, I guess, but the Bothan clans have, well,
they've declared genocide against the Vong, and Creefy's taking it to heart. It's called Arkray. I don't think I want the Council to declare its support for mass murder, even the mass murder of Yuuzhan Vong.
Saba Sebatine put an elegant, scaled hand onto the table.
I and my kindred are highly experienced in this kind of force melding that Admiral Creefy desires for his Jedi. Perhaps I should point out something that others may not have realized. If Creefy succeeds in building this meld in his forces, it will not be Creefy who commands his fleet. It will be us.
The last sibilant hiss floated down the table to Saba's startled audience. Trebek, vastly amused, gave an untranslatable roar.
The fleet will be conditioned to obey the orders of the Jedi,
Saba went on.
They will fight at our direction and under our leader's ship. Should Creefy attempt any sort of, shall we call them, illegal actions, he will need both our permission and cooperation. It would be within our power to withhold them.
The others watched Saba for a long, silent moment. Then Luke said, I think we should send Jedi.
Master Skywalker,
Sil'gal said, you have throughout the war warned us of the dangers of aggression. But now you send Jedi to war under a commander who will use them aggressively. Have you changed your mind?
I have changed my policy, yes, Luke answered. At once he had Kip Duran's full attention.
What changed your mind?
New information.
Luke looked up.
From Jason Solo, and from Vergere. It's now possible to understand that the Yuuzhan Vong aren't some exception to the rules of creation. If we can't see them in the Force, it's our fault, not theirs. We can fight them without wanting to wipe them from existence. We can fight them without hate and without darkness.
If you want the practical argument, Kip, the Chief of State has now given us his full support and made a place for the Jedi in the government. It seems only polite to support the government that is supporting us.
That's all very well, Kip said. But your warnings about aggression weren't without foundation. It's still possible for the darkness to take our people. I know. I've been there.
Luke hoped this was true. We have to trust the Jedi and their training, he said. We've given all the warnings we can. The meld is another tool we can try to use.
Is that all, then? Luke asked.
Trissina rolled up her snout to allow herself to speak without being muffled.
I'd like to ask about the Jedi apprentices just arrived, with a refugee convoy here on Mon Calamari. They have no masters or current duties. What are we to do with them? Send them to...
She hesitated on the verge of letting a secret slip.
To join the other apprentices at the Hidden Academy? Who are we talking about?
Asked Sil'gal.
Zek and Tahiri Vela.
All were with my son Tessar on the strike at Merkur,
Saba said.
They're all warriors, then,
Kent Habner said.
Veterans. They'll all be needed.
He turned to Luke.
Perhaps we should promote them to Jedi Knight. Then they can decide for themselves where they'll be most useful.
Luke hesitated, then spoke.
Tahiri is very young, not even 16, and she was a special friend to Anakin.
He shook his head.
Knighting her and sending her against the Yuuzhan Vong might be sending her straight to the dark side.
Send them to Kashyyyk, Saba said. Send them to Tessar and to the Meld. Send Alim Arar as well. The Force Meld will save them from the dark side.
Saba's sincerity was convincing. Luke nodded.
Very well.
There are other apprentices who were with Anakin's strike force,
Kent reminded.
Jaina, Jason, and Lobaka, and of course Sil'gal's apprentice, Tekly. Shouldn't we promote them as well?
Luke felt embarrassment that he hadn't realized this himself.
Of course.
Don't forget Tennel Kaa, Kip added. Cal's eyes lit up.
They'll be the first Jedi Knights of the New Order. Shouldn't you do something special when you knight them? A ceremony or...
Luke laughed. Do you want to make a speech so badly, Cal? There's never been any ceremony in the past. Cal flushed a little, but said,
Why not have one? They're heroes, and people should know it. Bring them all here, and I'll pin medals on them and talk until their ears turn blue.
Luke found himself grinning at Cal's zeal. Perhaps a ceremony was in order, just to show everyone. The Jedi, not least of all, that things had changed.
The brilliant leadership of Anakin Solo.
Cal's voice, unusually formal and ringing and solemn, filled the darkened auditorium.
As we honor these young warriors, let us never forget the others who shared their mission but never returned. Ulaha Kor,
Errol Bessa, Jovan Drark, Reynar Thol, Bela and Krasov Hara, Ganna Riso, who returned from Merkur only to die later in defense of a comrade. As each name was called, an image of each Jedi apprentice was projected above the stage, floating as a kind of ghostly presence. Cal turned toward Luke. Master Skywalker will now take the podium. Cal left the podium and rejoined the High Council at stage right, his feet falling into the solemn rhythm of the drums. Luke, dressed simply in his Jedi robes, marched in the opposite direction and passed Cal along the way. Luke reached the podium. The roll call of the Jedi goes back for many millennia. We are here to welcome 9 new members into the Order. Each has felt the Force grow within him or her. Each has felt the sting of combat and the pain of a comrade's loss. Each has searched his or her heart and now stands ready to make the commitment to serve the New Republic for as long as life lasts. Luke turned to the apprentices standing in their line at stage left. Each was dressed simply in a jacket, trousers, and boots. As I name you, may you step forward and be garbed in the robes of a Jedi Knight. Tanel Kaa, the Queen of 63 Worlds, for good or ill, took formal precedence over the others. As drums began a solemn march, she stepped from the line of apprentices and came to stand by the podium. Remove your lightsaber, please. 2 Jedi Masters, Kenth Hamner and Kip Duren, stepped forward from the group of the Jedi Council carrying Tennel's new robe. They pulled the robe around her, then buckled her lightsaber over it. Luke reached over Tennel's shoulders, took her cowl, and drew it over her head. Tanel Kaa returned to her place. Luke stepped back to the podium. Tesser Sebateen. The Barabel came forward, and it was his mother Saba, assisted by Kenth Hamner, who clothed him in his robes. Alima Rar. Alima stepped from the rank of her comrades. Lobaka. The ginger-haired Wookiee towered over Luke and looked down at him with a fanged grin. Luke couldn't help but grin back. Jason Solo. Jason stepped out in silence, and Luke could sense his readiness in the Force. He took Jason by the shoulders. Jason, Luke said, never stop asking questions. Jason seemed stunned. I never thought I'd hear you say that. Jason returned to the line, radiating bemusement. Zek. Zek was robed by Kip and by Luke himself. All were Jedi who knew darkness firsthand. Tahiri Vela. On bare feet, the little blonde girl stepped forward, brave and pale in the darkness. Silgal and Saba robed her. Tekli. Silgal and Trissina robed her. Jaina Solo. Kip and Kenth Hamner, the 2 pilots, robed her. Luke put his hands on her shoulders and looked into her dark eyes, and a chill suddenly seized him, flooding his nerves with cold fire. I name you the Sword of the Jedi, he said. You are like tempered steel, purposeful and razor keen. Always you shall be in the front rank, a burning brand to your enemies, a brilliant fire to your friends. Yours is a restless life, and never shall you know peace, though you shall be blessed for the peace that you bring to others. Take comfort in the fact that, though you stand tall and alone, others take shelter in the shadow that you cast. Luke fell silent, and for a long, horrified moment, he stared into Jaina's wide-eyed face. He hadn't meant to say that. He hadn't meant to say anything like it. Yet the words had poured forth from him like the ringing sound of a giant bell. A bell that was being tolled, not by Luke, but by someone else. Luke's hands trembled as he drew the cowl over Jaina's head. When he returned to the podium, he had to fumble for the microphone switch. Draw your lightsabers. For the first time as Jedi Knights,
The click swoosh of 9 igniting lightsabers hissed through the air. He turned to the newly minted Jedi Knights and drew his own lightsaber as the Jedi members of the Council drew theirs. We salute you for the first time as colleagues. And he and the Council members performed a ritual salute with their lightsabers. Jason was on the bridge of Admiral Creefy's flagship, the Bothan assault cruiser Ralroost. He left his life on Mon Calamari with small regret. He had enjoyed his brief respite from the war, enjoyed the company of his parents, of Luke and Mara and Danny Quee, but he as well as Luke knew that it was time to move on. Once he joined Creefy, Jason's experience with the Jedi Meld on Merkur had helped him rise above the weeks of training that he'd missed. And in time, it had become obvious that his talents were less tactical than spatial and holistic. Through the Force and through the combined minds and perceptions of the Jedi, he seemed to gain a sense of the entire battlefield. He could sense where to move tactical elements and when to press an attack, and when to hold back or withdraw. With the other Jedi as his eyes and ears, he felt the necessity of moving a squadron here, of pulling back the main body there, of maintaining a hovering threat elsewhere. He couldn't have said why he knew this. He only knew that he knew. 2 months of constant raids and skirmishing had demonstrated that Jason's chief value wasn't in the cockpit of a starfighter, but on the bridge of a flagship, where he could help direct an entire armada.
I believe I found the trap I've been looking for,
Akbar said.
The trap will spell the doom of the Yuuzhan Vong.
He floated in his pool at home, with Luke, Cal Omas, and Admiral Sov sitting in plush chairs on the rim. Winter stood by with a holo projector. She switched on the projector, and a star map floated in the air over Akbar's head.
This is Treskov 115W, Akbar said,
as one of the stars blinked against the background.
It's an old main-sequence star on the outermost fringe of the deep core, completely unexceptionable. As you can see from the overlay of our official hyperspace route charts,
a narrow golden ribbon appeared on the display, a hyperspace route leading to the blinking star.
Treskov is a dead end. But if we add the secret Imperial core routes that Princess Leia brought back from Bastion...
4 other routes appeared on the display, marked in red and radiating from Treskov.
You see that unmarked routes from Treskov lead farther into the core. One of these,
another blinking light,
leads to an Imperial starbase codenamed Tarkin Sfang. The base was sealed and evacuated at the end of the Galactic Civil War, but otherwise remains intact and usable.
Perspective shifted on the hollow, the display zooming to display Treskov and its system. The fifth planet out, a gas giant striped in white and several shades of green began to wink.
This is Abak, a gas giant with 11 moons. Of these, Abak 9 was once exploited by the Deep Core Mining Corporation for its deposits of bronzium. I propose we reoccupy the moon and use it as bait in a trap. We must make it an irresistible target for the Yuuzhan Vong. And then, once the enemy begin their assault, we seal off the end and turn the Treskov system into a killing ground in which the enemy forces are hunted down and destroyed.
Akbar turned to Cien Sov.
Admiral, it is you who must commit the forces necessary to destroy the Yuuzhan Vong.
And then Akbar turned to Luke, and Luke felt a chill run down his spine.
Master Skywalker, it is for you and the Jedi to provide the bait.
I'm calling this meeting of the High Council for 2 reasons,
Cal Omas said.
First, we must discuss Admiral Akbar's plan for a renewed attack against the Yuuzhan Vong. Second,
Intelligence Director Diff Scour has an announcement of critical importance. The council members weren't as crowded as they had been at their first meeting, even though they met in the same room with the same overlarge table. I have no intention of communicating the details of Admiral Akbar's plan to this council. Its usefulness depends on secrecy, and in any case, it's irrelevant to the case I wish to put. Akbar's plan requires detaching large forces from their current deployments and using them against the Yuuzhan Vong. This will mean that many of our squadrons now engaged in the defense of our worlds won't be available in case the Yuuzhan Vong choose to attack.
Sir, our briefings have indicated that many more ships will be available in 6 standard months or so, said the soft voice of Talam Ranth. Would it not be possible to delay our offensive until we can both defend our planets and attack the enemy?
There's a time limit on the Admiral's plan, Luke said. We currently have a technological advantage over the enemy. We don't know how long this advantage will last, so the Admiral wants to move now.
If I may interrupt, Diff Scour said, I'd like to bring my own business before the Council.
Luke looked at the thin man with care. When Akbar had first presented his plan, Scour had been meticulous about discovering Akbar's timing. Scour looked from one council member to the next.
I am now able to reveal the existence of a secret unit in New Republic intelligence called Alpha Red. Since the beginning of the war, Alpha Red has undertaken covert research on Yuuzhan Vong biology with the assistance of a team of scientists supplied by the Chiss.
Why Chiss?
Sian Sov asked, bewildered.
The Chiss come from a hidden remote section of the galaxy far from the Yuuzhan Vong invasion routes,
Scour said.
It was highly unlikely that the enemy would have infiltrated them. Our xenobiologists and geneticists have investigated Yuuzhan Vong genetics. They have located a unique genetic signature in Yuuzhan Vong DNA, something common to all Yuuzhan Vong species, the plants, the living buildings and ships, the animals, and Vong themselves. This genetic signature is unknown in any plant, animal, bacterial, or viral life within our own galaxy.
You've developed a weapon,
Talam Ranth said.
Yes.
Cal's face was grim.
We have a weapon. A biological weapon, Diff Scour said. An airborne weapon that will attack only those plants or animals that possess the genetic signature of the extragalactic Vong. If the weapon is dispersed efficiently on enemy worlds, we calculate that the menace of the Yuuzhan Vong will be ended within 4 weeks at the most, probably 3.
What do you mean, ended?
Asked Silgal.
I mean the Vong will be dead,
Scour said.
And everything the Yuuzhan Vong brought with them. All the plants, all the buildings, all the ships.
He glanced briefly at each of the council members.
Biological weapons are notoriously capricious. Normally, I would never recommend their use in a dispersed population like the Vong. But this weapon will be so effective that I consider it an exception to my usual rule. The Vong can't escape it. It will attach to their genetics. They will be infected by their ships, their weapons, their armor, their homes, their food. Once the breakdown starts, the Vong will be dead within 3 or 4 days.
Luke let the horror sink in. The horror was followed by anger. Anger is a useful emotion, he remembered Vergere telling him, and he turned to Kal Omas.
How long have you known about this?
Since I was sworn in, Kal said.
Almost 3 months.
Talam Ranth turned his red eyes to Luke.
Master Skywalker obviously objects to this plan. I wish he'd explain his protests.
Luke looked at the others.
The Jedi exist to preserve life.
This slaughter of entire species runs contrary to our principles. Let me point out that the Yuuzhan Vong are not so completely unlike us. They are intelligent and educable. If you took one of their young and raised it, the child wouldn't be unlike one of ours. Their evil isn't innate to the species. It's their government and their religion that have made them aggressive, and it should be our task to defeat that government and religion, not to wipe out the common people who have had no choice but to follow their leaders.
The Yuuzhan Vong have done this to our worlds,
Idar Nilaikirka pointed out.
They've sown our worlds with life forms that have killed everyone on the planet.
Trebek gave a roar that brought silence to the table.
I know something of science,
he said finally through translation.
I know the word blowback.
He glanced at the others.
For those who don't know this term, it describes a weapon's unanticipated side effects turning on the user.
He looked at Difskauer.
You're planning to distribute Alpha Red throughout Vong space. Billions upon billions upon billions of live bacteria or viruses or whatever Alpha Red is cast loose on viable ecosystems.
He shook his shaggy head.
You can't tell me that Alpha Red won't mutate. Not in all those replications. And you can't assure me that one of those mutations won't be harmful to us. Blowback could kill all of us.
Scour shrugged.
If this is a worry, we can quarantine Vong worlds until we can assure they're safe.
You haven't spoken of Yuuzhan Vong biological capabilities, Luke said. Scour raised an eyebrow.
I don't understand, Master Skywalker.
The Yuuzhan Vong have formidable biological knowledge, Luke said. They do everything through biotech. Can you tell me that they haven't anticipated this form of attack? How do you know that once they see we're ready to commit genocide and ecocide both, they won't retaliate in kind? For the first time, Scour seemed at a loss.
We have no evidence to show anything of the sort.
Have you looked? Luke asked. Scour seemed nettled.
Our knowledge of the enemy is deficient,
Talam Ranth said. His double-horned head turned slowly left and right, scanning the table. Clearly, it would be illogical to proceed with this plan.
Perhaps we should vote, Cal said. Those in favor?
Difskauer's hand went up first. Then Nilaikirka's. Then, with hesitation, the hand of Cien Sov. Luke kept his hands on the table. So did all the Jedi. I cast Saba Sebatine's proxy against the motion.
And I cast Kip Duren's, Silgal echoed.
The motion fails, Reliki Aukla said.
Then Cal Omas turned to Luke. There was regret in his eyes.
I'm sorry, Luke. But in a war that we're losing, we can't afford to throw away any weapons. Particularly one that will end so much suffering and heartache for our people.
He turned to Difskauer.
This council is advisory, not legislative. As chief of state, I order Difskauer to continue the Alpha Red project.
Luke sat stunned. Sorrow dug deep furrows into Cal's brows.
This is a tragedy in every way. But our only choice is between one tragedy and another. And I prefer to make the Vong story a tragedy, and not ours.
He looked at Difskauer.
When can you have your weapon ready? There is only a small sample of the material at present, Skauer said. We'll need to produce much more, tons at least. I anticipate enough product can be made to begin distribution within 2 weeks.
Cal turned to the others.
In that case, we'll postpone implementation of Admiral Ackbar's offensive plans. We may as well stay on the defensive until Alpha Red wins the war.
Luke returned home after the meeting of the High Council with dread and anger warring in his mind. He felt Mara and the Force before she entered the apartment. She paused for a moment in the doorway, her own Force awareness gently enfolding him, and then she closed the door, put down the briefcase she was carrying, and joined him on the floor.
"What's the bad news?"
Luke hesitated, but he knew Mara could be trusted, and besides, the horror was too vast to keep to himself. He told her about Alpha Red. Mara drew back slightly as she considered the problem.
"What can we do?"
"We can protest. We can refuse to have anything to do with it. That's all I can think of."
"Protest, yes, but how publicly?"
Luke shook his head. "Too public and the Yuuzhan Vong find out. Then they could hit us with bioweapons first and it would be catastrophe."
"You say that Treback knows, and that Talaam Ranth voted with you."
"Yes."
"You need to contact them. See if they can change the minds of others on the High Council."
Luke nodded. "A quiet lobbying campaign, then. Diffscour caught me by surprise, and I didn't have my arguments in order." He nodded and kissed Mara's cheek.
"Thank you." "You're welcome."
She rose to her feet and helped him to rise. He walked to the back of the apartment to change and wash before helping with dinner, and then froze as he saw a bundle of feathers in the spare room.
Vergère.
She had been in the apartment all along. She was crouched in a meditation posture, her knees high, her head tucked in. Horrified, Luke returned to Mara. "Vergère's in her room. I didn't sense her when I came in." Mara's green eyes widened.
"I didn't either. She was making herself invisible again."
"Do you think she heard us?" Mara considered. "It isn't as if we were shouting. We were centimeters from each other, practically whispering. How could she have heard?"
"I wouldn't put anything past her."
Mara's look hardened.
"Neither would I."
Vergère was a model of innocence for the next 8 days, during which time Luke and Mara kept track of her when she wasn't with Silgal or other Jedi. During that time, Luke's lobbying efforts were nothing but frustration. Cal listened politely to his arguments, but didn't change his mind. On the morning of the 9th day, New Republic security burst down the door and swept through the apartment. Diffscour had come in person, flinty eyes hard in his gaunt face.
"The Chief of State wants to see you," he told Luke.
His eyes flicked to Mara.
"And Mara may come as well."
Cal Omas was in his office. He was unshaven and disheveled and had clearly just risen from bed. He looked at Luke with eyes of stone.
"Where's Vergère?"
"We saw her tonight, in her room," Luke said.
"What has she done?" "As if you didn't know."
Diffscour breathed from behind Luke's shoulder.
"Vergère has sabotaged Alpha Red," Cal said.
Luke's mouth went dry.
"Sabotaged it how?"
"The Alpha Red team was in the process of moving to a Nebulon B cruiser in orbit. Somehow Vergère got on board in the confusion. She's wiped the records, and somehow she's
altered the weapon."
"Altered?" Luke echoed. "Rendered it ineffective. We don't know how." Through her tears, Luke thought, she could modify the weapon at the molecular level. Cal's eyes bored into Luke.
"So where is she?"
"I don't know."
"Where would she run to?"
"Back to the Vong, of course," Diffscour said. "She's been working for them all along."
"She doesn't owe the Yuuzhan Vong her allegiance any more than we do," Mara added. "She's a servant of the Old Republic, not the New."
"So tell us why the Old Republic wants the Yuuzhan Vong to win the war,"
Diffscour shouted.
"She doesn't," Luke said. "She just doesn't want an atrocity like Alpha Red to be unleashed."
"Sir,"
Diffscour spoke to Cal,
"if she goes back to the Vong with Alpha Red, then the New Republic is in jeopardy. The enemy will know our capabilities and they'll have to do whatever they can to destroy us before we can revive the Alpha Red Project.
The Skywalkers think she won't go to the Yuuzhan Vong, Cal said.
They've been wrong up until now, Skower said. And in any case, we can't afford to take the chance.
True. Cal's eyes moved restlessly over his desk.
All right, then.
He looked at Skower.
You need to reestablish Alpha Red at a safer location. And have the team duplicate their original work. That will take how long? At least 3 months, probably four.
Cal nodded. He turned to Luke.
We'll move on Akbar's plan immediately. If the Vong are responding to Akbar's moves, then maybe they won't have time to kill the rest of us.
Yes, sir, Luke said. His mind buzzed with calculation. It would be 3 or 4 months before Alpha Red was unleashed. That meant Luke had 3 months to win the war. If the enemy were on the edge of defeat, then perhaps Cal wouldn't feel it necessary to wipe the Yuuzhan Vong from existence. In his small cabin, Jason began to record a holovid letter to his parents when he realized he wasn't alone, not even in his own mind.
Vergère?
He probed. In return, Jason received impressions, pictures of a green treetop landscape that he recognized as Kashyyyk, and a strong nonverbal command to come to the planet. And this was followed by an equally powerful compulsion to silence. A secret meeting? Jason sent. There was no reply. Jason received permission to leave Ralroos from the officer of the deck and took his X-Wing to the surface, homing on Vergère's presence in the Force. She had chosen a small remote island for the meeting place. The meeting place was marked by an old four-passenger Trilon shuttle, perched at a dangerous angle in the uppermost branches of one of the Rocher trees. Jason floated the X-Wing toward it on his repulsor lifts and carefully dropped the starfighter onto an interwoven net of branches. As he shut off the repulsor lifts and let the branches take the fighter's weight, he was surprised by the sight of a 4-meter-long, many-toothed serpent flying past his canopy.
Their instinct is to eat birds, Vergère explained, as Jason climbed out of the cockpit and lowered himself to one of the massive Rocher limbs. I try to discourage them, but they are unintelligent and thus persistent. As Vergère spoke, another larger snake was torn free in a shower of green foliage from an overhanging limb and went whipping through the air and over the green horizon. If I throw them into the sea, Vergère said, it delays their return, but they do come back.
Jason looked at her.
Why are you here? Did you run away? Is Nylai Kirka after you? Nylai Kirka and many others. Your Master Skywalker among them, I think.
Jason took a deep breath. He squatted on his heels on the wide branch and said,
You'd better tell me.
Vergère told her story. Jason was horrified. Vergère looked at him.
I have given the Jedi only a few months to respond to this horror.
They can rebuild the weapon?
Of course.
What are you going to do? He asked. She craned her long neck to look at her shuttle.
My craft came to Mon Calamari with a family of refugees who sold it to buy food. Sooner or later, the dealer to whom they sold it will notice that it's missing from its orbit. And then there'll be a search, but that won't matter. The hyperdrive engines are ready to give up the ghost, and I'll be lucky to get out of the Kashyyyk system.
She turned to Jason.
Can you give me a ride in your fighter?
Certainly. But to where?
To your ship, perhaps?
He blinked at her.
It's an assault cruiser. It's got over 1,000 crew.
It's easy to pass as one among thousands, yes? And I would be less conspicuous in a uniform, no?
Jason sighed. He sensed an inevitability in the offing.
Let's hope there aren't any big snakes aboard. I'm glad to know that creepy little bird is gone, Han said. It was all I could do not to wring her neck for what she did to Jason.
He looked around. Where did Vergere go to anyway?
I'm not sure, Luke said.
He quelled the uneasiness in his mind and asked Han and Leia to sit. The pair took the seats offered and then the drinks that Mara brought into the room. Mara took her own drink and sat on the sofa next to Luke. He put his arm around her.
I wanted to tell you I'll be leaving for a while, Luke said. I'm going across the galaxy to Fondor, and I'm not sure when I'll be back.
Leia looked at him. Is it something you can talk about?
I'm going to Garm Bel Iblis, Luke said.
He commands at Fondor, and since the fall of Coruscant, he's been operating independently of Cian Sov and the military.
Just like he did in the rebellion, Han said. Bel Iblis likes running his own show.
When he was given orders, at first he responded that the situation in his sector was different than the Supreme Commander thought, and therefore he declined to carry them out. Lately, he hasn't been responding to orders at all.
You brought him into the fold once before, Leia said. I guess Cal thinks he can do it again.
It hasn't been important until now, Luke said.
Bel Iblis has been doing more or less what he should have been doing anyway, defending his sector and harassing the enemy. But now Akbar has a plan to win the war, and we need to know whether Bel Iblis will be in at the finish.
Luke turned to Han. Speaking of Akbar, he asked me if you'd do him a favor. Ice rang in Han's glass as he drained it.
Anything.
He'd like you to resume your military rank and take command of a squadron. Han placed his glass firmly on the table next to his seat.
You know, I never did take to the military. And the military never took to me. If Akbar just wants to make both me and the fleet miserable.
He'd like you to take command of the squadron contributed by the Smugglers Alliance, Luke said. Talon Card, Booster Tarek, and the Errant Venture. They're a hard bunch. Anarchic and rebellious and undisciplined. The ships are a heterogeneous jumble, and any tactics would have to be improvised by the squadron commander.
Leia, a little grim, turned to her husband.
I'd use the word never if I were you. Lando's part of it too, Luke added.
You know he'd make mincemeat out of a regular fleet officer.
Anyone who could control that bunch would have to be as rough as they are, and as experienced. The commander would have to be able to fly the pants off any of them. And
whip 50 times his weight in angry crate dragons, Leia finished.
She looked at Han. You see what my brother's trying to do, don't you? He's trying to flatter you into taking this job. He's trying to tell you that only Han Solo could possibly be tough enough for this assignment.
Han smiled.
He's right, of course. But the word never is still on the tip of my tongue.
Luke sighed. You're going to force me to fight dirty. I really didn't want to do this.
Han laughed.
Hit me with your best shot.
Luke made an apologetic gesture.
During the upcoming operation, the Smugglers Alliance Squadron will be in support of Admiral Creefy's fleet, which includes your children.
Sorry. Han looked stricken. Leia narrowed her eyes and glared at her brother.
That is really underhanded, Luke.
Now it's all up to us again, isn't it?
Luke smiled. The fate of the galaxy may well rest in your hands.
Yes, it's unfair. But that's the way it is.
Leia raised a fist.
When this is over, remind me to hit you.
Luke raised his hands peaceably.
Kip's first in line, but then you can take all the shots you want.
We're installing blast-proof doors here, the engineer said. Once you get your people inside, you can drop the doors and be perfectly safe for, several hours at least.
Several hours at least, Jaina repeated. She looked at the busy droids, which were lifting huge, clattering pneumatic hammers to widen the old mineshaft. What no one had yet explained to her was why she would have to seek safety from the enemy in the tunnels of a back nine, which seemed to be a perfectly useless moonlet at the end of a twisty hyperspace passage into the deep core. But that seemed a part of the plan, whatever the plan was. Aback 9 was abuzz with military engineers modifying the docking bays that once held mining shuttles, installing shields and a modern communication system, bringing the old life support and artificial gravity systems up to current specs. The engineers were protected by a reinforced squadron under General Farlander, 40 capital ships in all, far larger than the force he'd led at Abroa Sky. Farlander, with Jaina under his command, was supposed to defend this useless moon. Why hide? Why defend Aback 9 in the first place? The plan didn't make any sense. All she knew were the drills. Maneuvers aimed at readying Farlander's squadron for defending the mined-out moon. Then more maneuvers aimed at breaking off combat, landing on the moon, and hiding deep underground. According to rumor, this plan was Akbar's work. Jaina hoped not, because that meant that Akbar, as well as his plan, was insane. Time to give them their first hint, Mara said. The first hint of the final redoubt in the deep core. Nylikirka's eyes brightened.
How much should we tell them?
Just give them a hint at first, Mara advised. We don't want to hand them the whole thing. If they put the pieces together themselves, they'll believe even more in what they're learning.
Very well, Nylikirka said.
Perhaps the office of Senator Kral Pragat could hear about an emergency appropriation for a base in the Deep Core, and you could combine that with a leak concerning an evacuation drill for the Chief of State and the Advisory Council. Nylikirka's airsec throbbed thoughtfully.
Yes. Yes, I think that might do the job.
Stars blossomed around Jason as Ralroost fell out of hyperspace. He sat in front of Admiral Creefy on the assault cruiser's bridge, with tactical displays laid out around him. They were as deep in the deep core as he'd ever ventured, the stars packed so tightly around them that it was never quite night.
Aback 9... Creefy said meditatively, as the moon and its giant primary appeared on the navigation arrays. He turned to Jason.
If you wish to see your sister, you have my permission.
Thank you, sir.
Jason rose from his seat and withdrew from Ralroost's bridge. Creefy's fleet had reached the end of their long, erratic journey. While Farlander's squadron had flown directly to Aback, Ralroost and the rest of Creefy's fleet had been engaged in a series of raids against the enemy. On every occasion, the Jedi wove their force mill to coordinate the attacking forces. Diversionary raids, Creefy had explained after they were over. They were designed to show the enemy that Creefy and his fleet were anywhere but where they were going, Aback 9 and the Deep Core. Being continually in action meant that Jason had been unable to smuggle Verger off the flagship. After 2 days of hiding her in the cockpit of his X-Wing, he managed to smuggle her to his quarters. Fortunately, he was in officer's quarters and had a room to himself. Leaving Ralroost, Jason took his X-Wing to the moonlet and met Jaina in the docking bay that had been modified to fly an armed military craft.
I don't know what we're doing here, she said, after giving him a weary embrace. Half the time we're drilling on launching to defend the system, and the rest of the exercises have us running for bunkers.
We've got dozens of capital ships here, Jason said. We have all the Jedi we need to form a meld. We can start joint exercises.
You all can't run for bunkers, Jaina said. She shook her head. This is worse than anything I've ever seen. I hate this. I'm just nailed to this rock. It's like we have a huge target sign pasted on us.
I just realized what's happening, he said.
Jaina looked at him, and apprehension dawned in her brown eyes.
You're the bait, Jason told her. You're the bait that will bring the Yuuzhan Vong here.
He paused, and then nodded as he followed the thought to its inevitable conclusion.
And I'm the bait, too.
The door shivered open, and Nomanor's heart lurched at the sight of a grotesque face grinning at him like some demon's parody of a Yuuzhan Vong. He controlled himself as he realized it was only Anami, who broke into a slash-mouthed grin and ushered him into the room with a bow. Nomanor imagined kicking Anami out of his way as he stepped into the shadowed room. In the dim light, he made out the huge form of Supreme Overlord Shimra reclining on a dais of pulsing red howl polyps. The Overlord's deep voice rolled out of the darkness.
You have news of the infidels?
I have, Supreme One. I believe that I have the information that will bring about the decisive battle.
Shimra's voice was deadly calm.
Very well, Executor. We shall await the War Master.
As you wish, Dread One.
Anami opened the door before Savang La could touch its membrane. Savang La padded balefully into the room on his clawed Vuasa foot, his eyes glaring hatred at Nomanor.
At your command, Supreme One.
Report, War Master.
The fleets are ready, Dreadlord. With your permission, I am ready to take Corellia, 5 planets in the system, Lord, shipyards, and the center point weapon.
Eagerness contorted his scarred face.
May I have your permission to advance, Supreme One?
A giggle escaped Anami's slash of a mouth.
I believe Nomanor has another suggestion.
Nomanor felt the War Master's anger as Savang La glowered at him.
This one? I have followed his advice before, to my cost.
Speak, Executor,
Shimra said.
My spies inform me that the New Republic government has fled Mon Calamari and is hiding in the Deep Core. Their War Master and his forces may trap them there and crush them. Without a central government, the enemy will fall apart.
Savang La's expression hesitated between triumph and scorn.
What spies? What evidence? How do we know this isn't a trap? I have correlated the evidence from different independent networks operating on Mon Calamari,
Nomanor said.
The plans for what the enemy calls the final redoubt came from one source. Its location came from another agent. News of an emergency appropriation to pay for it came from a third.
He smiled.
And the fact that the final redoubt is guarded by Jedi, in fact, by the Solo Twins, came from my most reliable agent.
Shimra leaned forward on the trembling bed of polyps.
Now let us examine this evidence and make our plans.
Alarms blasted Jaina from sleep. So frequent had been the drills that she drew on her boots and grabbed her pilot's helmet without even opening her eyes. She managed to pry open her gummed lids as she sprinted down the corridor that led to the docking bays. 5 strides later, the artificial gravity snapped off as the moonlet's defense shields went on. Power supply problems had been continuous and, judging by present evidence, were unresolved. Jaina used the force to push herself forward, snagging Vale on the way as her wingmate floundered in the reduced gravity, unable to get traction for her boots. In the docking bay, Jaina flung Vale toward her starfighter, then jumped for her own X-Wing. R2-B3, which had never left the bay, was already in the second seat and had the electronics switched on, the repulsor lifts glowing and the quad ion engines warming. The astromech tweeted a greeting as Jaina buckled herself into her seat and watched the last of her squadron's pilots race, float, or flop their way through the reduced gravity to their craft. Jaina's X-Wing swung aloft on its repulsor lifts and floated toward the docking bay doors. As the massive doors parted for her, she triggered the ion engines and launched herself into the star-strewn half-night beyond. In space, as she waited for the others to launch and form on her starfighter, she looked at her displays and saw Farlander's capital ships hovering 8 light minutes out, all of them launching starfighters. And beyond Farlander, bright starbursts blossomed onto the displays, squadrons of enemy ships in their hundreds and thousands. This was not a drill. And then Jaina felt a surge through the Force, a sense that a powerful mind had just focused on her, like a searchlight on a helpless insect. Horror shivered through her bones as she recognized the sensation. Voxen.